This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
For South Africa, we've had quite unprecedented disasters that as a sign of being affected by global warming and global climate change, and therefore building resilient cities and inclusive of communities where communities are displaced and how we place them remains one of the most important things.
There was South Africa's Human Settlements Minister Mamaloko Kubai talking about the issues facing delegates at the UN Habitat Conference in Nairobi. Details coming up. Also, Pope Francis confronts a new health challenge, while South Africa's electricity woes are devastating some families. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Vatican says Pope Francis will be undergoing abdominal surgery in a Rome hospital. Charles Della Desma with the Associated Press has more.
Crowds cheer as Francis appears at his weekly general audience in Vatican City, zipping around St. Peter's Square in his Popemobile, greeting the faithful. The audience comes the day after he'd gone to hospital for a checkup. Now, however, the Pope, who is 86, will be put under general anaesthetic and hospitalised for several days. He's undergoing what the Vatican says is a laparotomy and abdominal wall plastic surgery with prosthesis to treat a recurrent, painful and worsening constriction of the intestine. The statement adds Francis is suffering from a blocked laparoseal, which is a hernia that can form over a previous scar. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The 86-year-old pontiff has had a number of health problems over the years. In 2021, the Pope had 33-centimeter section of his colon removed in an operation aimed at addressing a painful bowel condition called diverticulitis. He said earlier this year that the condition had returned. In March this year, he was treated in a hospital for bronchitis, and he has long suffered from back, hip and knee pain. Around the world, many people are worried about Pope Francis. In South Sudan, many people there particularly are concerned because in February, he was the first pope to visit the country. For VOA, Manyang David Mayar asked people in Juba about his latest illness. Here's what some of them had to say.
My name is acolyte Peter Attilio. Because of healing of Pope Francis, for me, Peter, I will pray for him because he's our father, Holiness Father, and secondly because we are all trusting him because he's our Pope. So I wanted for him to heal, to be okay like any people. Thank you.
My name is Elizabeth Joa Arcangelo. As I heard the message about the sickness of Pope, and also it reminds me when he comes here because I saw him physically and I know what he's thinking about South Sudan. But everything in the hands of God. So we leave it to God. We tell to God that may his healing hand reach to the Pope until he enters his operation, and the operation will be successfully in the name of God. And also I wish him quick recovery.
My name is William Okot from Juba, so in the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba. We are so sad to hear this issue, the health of Papa Francis. I think he's the first Pope who visited South Sudan. He risked his life to see this country where people are suffering. The rest are even fearing to come. But he came here to give us a message of peace, and he left. So we are praying, may God help him, or may God give him a healing hands.
Those were the thoughts of people in Juba about Pope Francis's latest health problems. U.S. First Lady Jill Biden has wrapped up her second visit to Africa in 3 months. During her stop this week in Morocco, she visited two programs funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development to empower youth and women. The visits aim to showcase U.S. support for locally driven solutions that support Moroccans in vulnerable situations as they address the social and economic challenges they face. Elizabeth Myers is the chief legal strategist for the Pan-African Institute for Municipal Development. She spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi about the First Lady's visit to Morocco.
The First Lady's visit to Morocco was part of her six-day trip to the Middle East and North Africa, highlighting the need to empower youth and women around the world. The purpose of her short three-day tour of Morocco was to connect with women and young people while focusing on the various U.S. investments that have helped support educational programs and efforts to increase economic opportunity. So it highlighted some of the local NGOs the U.S. funds through USAID and the Millennium Challenge Corporation. So she met with the Enakhil Association for Women and Children, which is an independent non-governmental organization created in 1997 in Marrakesh, and they operate a crisis center for victims of gender-based violence. Gender-based violence remains a serious problem in Morocco. So the organization provides legal help for women and children who are subjected to sexual violence, and it provides public awareness campaigns to fight against all kinds of violence against women and children. The association, Enakhil, has already received more than $820,000 of U.S. funding, and it's recently designed and launched a mobile app that enables virtual consultations for victims of violence, and it runs a solidarity restaurant where abused women can receive vocational training in an operating commercial setting. Another of those programs is the USAID's Cooperative Financing Program, which is an $18.2 million initiative implemented by GiveDirectly in partnership with the Moroccan government's National Initiative for Human Development. This program directly supports 1,400 Moroccan cooperatives that have been economically impacted by COVID-19, climate change, drought, and even inflation. This program is helping them revive production and improve livelihoods and helping women become more resilient. So Dr. Biden met with six women who lead cooperatives that have each received a $9,000 cash grant. She talked with the women about their work and took a look at the products and handicrafts that they make: argan and olive oil-based products, traditional clothing, embroidery, rugs, and hand-woven baskets. And the women presented the First Lady with a beautiful embroidered black and white silhem, a traditional cape.
So what was the Moroccan reaction to the visit of the U.S. First Lady?
Well, Morocco is, of course, the U.S.'s oldest ally, and there's been a special relationship between the two countries over the last 200 years. The U.S. has provided a lot of funding to Morocco through educational, investment, and economic development programs for decades. And really, Moroccans tend to view the U.S. in a positive light in general. And of course, many Moroccans have sent their kids to the U.S. for university. So Dr. Biden, who is known for her lifelong commitment to education, received a very warm welcome. And this was evident from the faces of the people smiling and waving Moroccan and American flags as she walked through the tight, windy, pedestrian-only streets of the old town of Marrakesh, known as the Medina. She toured the souk as well as the famous landmarks like the Madrasa Sidi Ben Yusuf, which is the newly renovated Islamic school built in the 1500s. The people on the streets were really pleased to see her.
That was Elizabeth Myers, chief legal strategist for the Pan-African Institute for Municipal Development. She spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi by phone. Before visiting Morocco, Biden was in Cairo and Jordan. She visited Namibia and Kenya in February as her husband, President Joe Biden, continues his effort to broaden U.S. engagement with Africa. A number of high-ranking U.S. officials have visited the continent over the past year. South Africa's Human Settlements Minister, Mama Loko Kubai, is leading the country's delegation to the second UN Habitat Assembly underway in Nairobi, Kenya. The assembly focuses on building a sustainable urban future using inclusive and effective multilateralism. Participants also are looking at ways to achieve these sustainable development goals despite multiple crises in the world. VOA's Ruben Chama spoke with Minister Kubai on the sidelines of the assembly. She began by highlighting some of the solutions coming out of the conference.
Firstly, on the global action plan of eradication of informal settlements and slum dwelling, we've championed that resolution, but we're also supportive of other resolutions. As we build cities, as we build communities, let's ensure that women are included. The issue of the new urban agenda, together with building resilient communities. For South Africa, we've had quite unprecedented disasters that as a sign of being affected by global warming and global climate change, and therefore building resilient cities and inclusive of communities where communities are displaced and how we place them remains one of the most important things. So when you look at the new urban agenda, you'll see that it talks about urbanization, where population will grow in terms of almost 70% that is moving to urban areas. And therefore, for cities to be ready to respond to that remains critical. And that's why these conversations happening here at UN Habitat Assembly are critical for us to champion that work, share experiences, but guide in terms of policy development across the globe.
And Minister, where do you see significant progress across the region? And also, what would you say are the pressing setbacks?
I think when we look at the SDG goal development attainment, you'd see that the sub-Saharan remains behind in terms of progress towards that. And part of the issue, we do need to pay attention to ensuring that we can develop goals. And that's why, as South Africa, for example, we championed the Global Action Plan as one of the mechanisms to accelerate progress towards ensuring that we can attain our SDG goals so that we are not left behind. The issues of resources, I always argue that when we talk about climate financing, majority of the time is focused on energy and a reduction of carbon emission. It forgets that impact of climate change displaces communities, and therefore there isn't resources that are allocated in resettling people. And that's quite of the issues that are important for us as global communities when we talk, so that we look at the financing model, because there are other communities that do not have anything. As communities are displaced, we've got to be able to support them in ensuring that even those are living within the level and standards that are acceptable. Issues of land availability and land tenure is critical in human settlements or even in terms of housing. The issue of basic services for the people to have the ability of water, electricity, and sanitation remains critical. And for us as a continent, those are some of the things that we've got to be able to champion.
That was South Africa's Human Settlements Minister, Mamaloko Kubayi, speaking with VOA's Ruben Chama from Nairobi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Judges at the UN War Crimes Court ruled that elderly Rwandan genocide suspect Felician Kabuga is unfit to stand trial, but said slimmed-down legal proceedings in his case can continue. In a decision published on the Hague's court's website on Wednesday, the judge said the decision came after doctors found Kabuga suffered from dementia. Louis Mudge is Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached him for a reaction on the court's decision.
When Felician Kabuga was arrested in 2020, when his trial started in 2022, victims of the genocide in Rwanda and us at Human Rights Watch were celebrating this. There's very, very credible evidence to support the allegations that he is one of the chief planners for planning, ordering, and carrying out the genocide in Rwanda. The fact that Kabuga has been deemed unfit to be convicted, frankly, is, I think, justice denied for the many, many victims of genocide in Rwanda. And I think it, in some ways, demonstrates that Felician Kabuga was able to escape justice right till the end. So I understand the judge has to make this ruling, and that is within his purview. But this is bitter news and disappointing news nonetheless.
Given the gravity of the alleged crimes against Mr. Kabuga, what do you think the victims now have to do?
Well, I'm not sure there's much they can do. Kabuga's case was always held within the residual mechanism of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. His case is unfolding in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And, you know, I think the hope, certainly of Human Rights Watch, and I think the hope of many victims, certainly the victims of the genocide who I've spoken to since he was arrested, was that in a free and fair and open trial, Kabuga would be made to explain for his role, his very important role that he is alleged to have committed. And now the fact that they're going to try some new accountability mechanism, they're going to try some new, you know, type of legal procedure, but one that does not have the possibility of a conviction, I think is deeply disappointing. Felician Kabuga, based on the crimes he is alleged to have committed and the evidence that has already been presented against him by groups like Human Rights Watch, he is someone who should very much face the possibility of spending the rest of his life, no matter how short it is, behind bars for the crimes he committed. And it is disappointing to think that that might not be the case.
Does your organization know what other remedy is there for the court? As they say, they have some other mechanism.
They proposed a vague alternative legal procedure that will resemble a trial, but without the possibility of convictions. I have to tell you this, I've been working at Human Rights Watch for 13 years. It's the first time I've encountered this in my professional capacity, but maybe there's precedent. I don't know what the court has in mind. It's not been very much laid out, and the news only broke today. But when you take away the possibility of conviction, it really does begin to make you question, you know, what type of procedure are we talking about? Felician Kabuga, the crimes he's alleged to have committed are not something that would come out at a Truth and Reconciliation Commission sort of session. He is alleged to have supported Radio Milcolin, which was the radio station that organized the killing in 94. And he is alleged to have been one of the key purchasers of many of the machetes that were used by the Interahamwe to kill men, women, and children who were fleeing for their lives. I guess the only sort of solace is that Felician Kabuga lived his life in hiding. He will go down as someone who's remembered for the war crimes and crimes against humanity he's alleged to have committed. And he was captured. So he was not able to die without having been at least presented. And, you know, that is something. That's not nothing. The fact that he was captured, there was hard work that went into capturing him, and he was arrested, that at least is some solace.
Is there fear that many of those responsible for the genocide in Rwanda are going to be too old to ever face justice?
I think it's legitimate fear. The genocide was almost 30 years ago, and time is moving on. Luckily, and in a very good way, Fulgence Kayishema, who was also an alleged mastermind of a particular massacre, so he's not on the level, in my opinion, of Felician Kabuga, but nonetheless, he is regarded as someone who was a real driving force. He was arrested last week in South Africa. So there is hope that these individuals will continue to be arrested, and that they'll continue to be held accountable for the crimes they've committed. But you raise a valid point. Time is moving on.
That's Louis Mudge, Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. Burundi's government has suspended the operations of the main opposition party in the Central African country, citing irregularities. Critics say the move is an attempt to stifle dissent ahead of 2025 legislative elections. The Interior Ministry announced the decision yesterday, and opposition members say it risks rekindling the political turmoil that has wracked the Great Lakes nations in recent years. The French news agency AFP says the National Freedom Council, or CNL, denounced its suspension as a serious violation of the Constitution. The ministry said it was responding to complaints by 8 CNL leaders who were ousted after opposing the party's president, Agathon Rwasa, in two recent party congresses. Large parts of one of Africa's major cities, Johannesburg, have had no electricity for days, with some energy experts saying its power grid has effectively collapsed. The damage goes far beyond dark factories and shops to tear apart families. Darren Taylor reports.
Johannesburg's a city of 6 million people. It's often called the financial, technological, and industrial hub of Africa. These days, however, many of its factories and businesses are quiet, paralyzed by constant and lengthy electricity outages. Highways and major roads are snarled with vehicles because traffic lights aren't working. Thousands of residents don't have water because reservoirs need power to pump water to homes. Meat rots in butcheries. During blackouts, criminals cut electrical cables to steal copper wiring, causing more outages, and attack citizens under cover of darkness. Johannesburg's residents are hurting, some more than others.
People are dying. People are just suffering to keep their loved ones alive. Now we collect Matosa's ashes.
James Eaton says his three-year-old daughter, Nehemiah, died in her mother's arms last Sunday. The little girl had a respiratory disease and had to breathe with the aid of an oxygen machine. But after 4 days without electricity, emergency backup batteries couldn't be recharged and the machine stopped working. The Eatons couldn't find any electricity near them, not even at the local hospital. Isaac Mangena is spokesperson for Johannesburg's City Power, which is affiliated to the national power company, Eskom.
We are really saddened ourselves as City Power if it gets to a point where people lose their lives because of the problems with power outages.
Mangena says at the time of Nehemiah's death, City Power was doing planned maintenance in her suburb. He says residents had been informed that their electricity would be off for 1 day, but then something went wrong.
After the plant maintenance, the electricity came back, but it tripped later because of overloading in the area that happened. The street where the child stays was also one of those that were affected.
A local politician says he's filing a lawsuit against the Johannesburg municipality to hold it responsible for Nehemiah's death. But James Eaton says all he wants is for someone from government to phone him to say sorry.
Their silence is deafening. The lack of empathy, the lack of sympathy. Do they even care? Now that she's gone, it's like we're left with this emptiness. I don't even know why we need to continue living, because what we lived for is gone now.
The governing African National Congress says the electricity breakdowns are a problem, but not a crisis. But just in Johannesburg alone, Mangena says City Power is trying to repair an average of 4,000 faults every day, and it cannot cope. Energy experts and residents say years of infrastructure neglect and graft, dating back to the presidency of Nelson Mandela in the 1990s, are now taking a terrible toll. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ethiopia says its forces in Somalia thwarted an Al-Shabaab attack on a base today in the Somali town of Dullo. Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs tweeted the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, ENDF, stopped the attackers in their tracks before they could wreak havoc. The ministry also said the ENDF neutralized suicide bombers and destroyed Al-Shabaab weapons. VOA Somali Service reports that residents in Dullo said they heard two explosions targeting the Ethiopian base outside the town this morning. Ethiopia keeps thousands of troops in Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab as part of the African Union mission to support the Somali government. Ethiopia also has non-AU forces there under an agreement with the Somali government to protect its borders. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.